Thanks a lot, Stephanie, and thanks again to everybody for coming. It's a real pleasure to be able to introduce our second panel today on agency enforcement and prosecution of regulatory crimes. So this morning we looked mostly at defining regulatory crimes, and we heard a lot about issues that can flow from the depth and breadth of the federal regulatory criminal code. And now I guess you could say we're turning to issues of how that broad code is implemented on the ground. So if you want to use Roscoe Pound's distinction, right, turning from law in books to law in action. And we all know law in action is critically important in determining the content of the actual prohibitions and effects on behavior. And so these two topics, though, as this morning's panel, I think, illustrated, really bleed into each other quite a bit. And I think we're going to hear a lot of the same themes in today's panel, things touching on, say, non-delegation issues, issues of separation of powers, issues of how to police agency discretion. And I think this panel, maybe even more than this morning's panel, at least to my mind, goes to an issue that I think is at the heart of this workshop, the overarching issue of what are we really doing when we regulate by prosecution, if that's the term you want to use. Is it regulation, or is it actually something different, right? Is it something that's unique to criminal law? And how you answer that question or your views on that question, I think, could inform your answers to a lot of normative questions and institutional questions about the framework that should apply to enforcement in these contexts. I tend to agree with Professor Richmond. I'm not sure there is an answer to that in American law, but I think just asking the question raises a lot of interesting issues that I think our panelists are going to touch on today. And they cover a wide range. They can be things, even building on Senator Lee's remarks, you know, going to how do we define the states of mind that we normally think of as important to criminal law. You know, what does recklessness mean in the context of corporate crime, where the situational determinants of liability are a lot more complex than they are in street crime and a lot more disaggregated? Can you even give it a sensible definition? Or things like what should we do when it comes to stakeholders? There's a big debate on about whether prosecuting corporations creates undeserved harms that are just too egregious in terms of the effect on stakeholders, employees, creditors, you name it, people who work for companies. When you look at the street crime context, at least until very recently, these harms are still completely egregious in the street crime context as well. The communities, the stakeholders in the street crime context are devastated by criminal policy, and until recently, stakeholder considerations didn't seem to be that legitimate. You know, and so what is the parallel there? You know, how do prosecutors give content to slippery terms like the public interest, right, in deciding what to do about regulating economic activity under the guise of criminal law, particularly when they're not subject to the same channels and constraints that we see agencies laboring under when trying to give content to similar mushy terms in the normal administrative law context? And questions like, what's the proper role of politics versus expertise in enforcement? We usually think, particularly when it comes to criminal law, politics really shouldn't be involved in enforcement. Maybe we think there's a little bit more room in regular agency enforcement. How you answer the question of are we regulating or are we doing something unique to criminal law might inform your views on that as well. There's a whole bunch of other things that I'm hoping our panelists will touch on. So let me stop talking and introduce them. I'm really happy they're here with us today. I'll introduce them in the order in which I asked them to speak today. And so first is Professor Rena Steinsor from the University of Maryland Law School. You've got their bios, but I'll just give you a few highlights of each of them. Professor Steinsor is the president of the Center for Progressive Reform and formerly was counsel to the Subcommittee on Commerce, Transportation, and Tourism of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, among other things. And then next will be Jim Copeland. Jim is the director of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Legal Policy, formerly a management consultant at McKinsey, and also a former law clerk to Judge Winter on the Second Circuit. Then will be Matt Axelrod, also a former Winter clerk, and now a partner at Cohen Milstein. where he's been for, I think, 5 or 6 months, and before that spent over a decade as a prosecutor with the Department of Justice, including 2.5, or I think a little bit more time, 2.5 years as an associate deputy attorney general, doing a lot of white collar and regulatory criminal work. And then finally, Kate Andreas, who's a professor at the University of Michigan Law School, and formerly was a special assistant and associate counsel to the president and chief of staff of the White House counsel's office, and a law clerk to Justice Ginsburg. So that's the order in which we'll go. Afterwards, I'll leave a couple of minutes for the panelists to respond to points that any of the others have made, and then I'll open it up to questions from you all. So, Rena.
So I understand that I am the resident lefty, the person that's going to shake things up because it's the afternoon is progressing and we're probably all having a sugar low. I will say that when I was listening to Senator Lee, I had a sensation I often have in Washington, which is that I felt that he and I were living on different planets. It's very disconcerting. And his is clearly a very prevailing planet. But let me do my best to shake things up. America's prisons, there are 5,000 of them, hold 2.3 million inmates, more than in any other country that records such statistics, including Russia. 4.1 million people live under the supervision of correctional institutions, primarily on probation, for a total of 6.4 million, or 1 in 34 Americans. But the question is, who are these people? African Americans are 8 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites. A young black man has a 32% chance of going to prison. His white counterpart has a 6% chance. We have in this country an absolutely myopic focus on street crime at the federal, state, and local level, and it is creating the most profound sense that there is inequality in our legal system. It's an enormous problem. At the same time, HSBC, the fourth largest bank in the world, at the time, signed a deferred prosecution agreement after having racked up, according to the Justice Department's statement of facts, the laundering of money for Mexican drug cartel, and they were not required to plead guilty to any federal crime. So, finally, I would just culminate all of this too big to jail stuff with the observation that it's routine for the Department of Justice to have economists come in and have a discussion with the prosecutors about whether, if they indict a corporation, the corporation will go out of business. The fourth largest bank in the world will go out of business if the Justice Department indicts them. And you have to just think the irony of this. Do we have economists coming in and having a discussion about whether any of the 50% of people who are arrested for drug offenses, for marijuana, are what is going to happen to their families and their neighborhoods if they are prosecuted for the crimes. So I would say that we have a very skewed system. That's my first argument. Health, safety, and environment is my area. I'm not going to stray into finance. I couldn't resist the HSBC thing, so you'll forgive me. And I don't want to leave the states out. I think they need to be much more active in the area of corporate problems and corporate malfeasance. I am going to talk to you for just very briefly about recklessness in the corporate world and give you just one example, and it is BP, we're all going to groan, the supposed rogue, who went rampaging across this country, causing spills of oil on the Alaska North Slope, killing people in a horrendous refinery explosion in Texas City, and finally killing 11 people aboard the Deepwater Horizon, and spilling 205 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. That company was not considered too big to fail. They did pay $4 billion ultimately in criminal penalties. There have been some low-level managers who have been prosecuted. They're now back in the Gulf getting new leases, trying to wriggle out of settlements they made with injured parties down there. They apologized repeatedly after each one of these incidents and then went on their merry way. So the question I would suggest to you is, why doesn't the criminal justice system create enough incentive for a company to straighten up its act and not get five bites at the apple when it is capable of such tremendous harm? I advocate prosecuting both corporations and individuals. I think they need to climb the corporate structure much higher than they have so far if BP is to be really deterred. And just to give you one anecdote about this, prior to the Texas City explosion, the plant manager was so concerned about safety at that facility that he commissioned a group of private consultants to come in and interview workers anonymously. And they reported that they were afraid to come to work, that the maintenance had so deteriorated, the safety practices were so lax, that they felt a fatal incident was just about to happen. So the plant manager, a man named Don Paris, who was unceremoniously dumped by BP after the explosion, went and visited the top executives for North America, the number two guy for global oil exploration, and said to them, this plant is so run into the ground, it needs immediately $200 million worth of repairs or people are going to be dying on the spot. And please, I'm begging you to stop cutting costs. Immediately after he had that conversation, another round of maintenance costs were imposed by the top executives of BP on that facility. And those cuts, which had been connected, he brought a PowerPoint with pictures of workers who had died on the job. Those maintenance cost cuts were, the implications of them were explained to those top executives, and yet it would be horrifying for us to ever consider that they would be culpable criminally, and I don't understand that. I could give you lots of other examples. I've written a book that will be coming out in January called Too Big to Jail, needless to say, about industrial catastrophes. And I hope you'll all buy a copy. It's going to be published by Cambridge University. It'll be provocative at the very least, certainly to my other panelists. But what I'd like to say is that we can't any longer insulate corporate executives on the theory that it's the workers who cause the problem. It's human error. It's never an institutional failure. There is never anything that companies do that create unacceptably high risks for their workers and for consumers. As Senator Lee was talking, I kept thinking about the compounder drug industry, this facility in New England that killed 64 people by shipping, knowingly shipping, meningitis-tainted injections out. And they turned the air conditioning off in their clean room at night. That's how the fungus grew there. Why aren't those guys indicted already? I don't get that. So I hope I've stirred things up. I hope my fellow panelists will either choose to sidestep me and talk about what we all came to talk about or respond, and we'll have a good time. Thanks.
Okay, Jim.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to go back a little more toward what we were here to talk about, although I am going to address a little bit some of Professor Steinsohr's comments. And I agree with Professor Richmond from the earlier panel that we really don't have a very clear historical civil versus criminal delineation in U.S. law. I mean, in Blackstone, he was pretty clear when it came to corporate criminal liability, saying that the corporation cannot commit crime in its corporate capacity, though its members may in their distinct individual capacities. But there was always, already at that time, an exception in the public nuisance arena. In the United States in the 19th century, this was applied to publicly traded but private corporations. And then, of course, 105 years ago, the Supreme Court said Congress has the power to create crimes and apply them to corporations. I am not going to revisit that decision here today. I think it's with us here to stay. I'm also not going to comment very broadly, as John did in the earlier panel, about the question of whether we have too many or too few regulations. I have opinions on that. They certainly differ with, I think, some of the other people up here. But I really want to sort of flesh out what we call the shadow regulatory state. And it's really the regulatory state through criminal law enforcement that Professor Richmond was talking about, where we have a sort of dual nature here. We have the administrative law state with a very controlled area of regulation with very precise rules, and then the very discretionary criminal regulatory state through the threat of prosecution that exists the Federal Department of Justice. And I first want to lay out some statistics to show that, A, this shadow regulatory state does exist and is significant in scope. Then, B, I want to go through five different issues briefly that I've written about in some more length, along with my colleague Isaac Gorodetsky, who's here today. And then, finally, I want to go through four different potential areas in which we could change things and potentially remedy some of those issues. So do we have this? Well, for 205 years of U.S. history, we didn't have what's now known as the Deferred Prosecution Agreement. Starting in 1993, we did. And in the first decade of the DPA or NPA's existence, we had 17 such agreements. In the following decade, we've had 278 such agreements. In the last 4.5 odd years alone, since the beginning of 2010, fully 10 of our Fortune 100 companies have been operating under DPA or NPA Justice Department supervision. And these span a broad array of industries, from J.P. Morgan Chase and MetLife, to Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Pfizer, to UPS, to Google, to Tyson Foods and ADM, a real broad array of companies operating under Justice Department supervision. In the last 2 years alone, there have been 66 federal DPAs and NPAs that we know of, with $66 billion with 66 DPAs or NPAs with $12 billion in fines or penalties imposed. And I use those in quotes because they're not real criminal fines that have been passed on after an adjudication. They're payments that are agreed to by the corporation in lieu of prosecution. Beyond that, there are a number of wholesale changes that companies have had to embrace under these DPA or NPA agreements, including the implementation of training and reporting programs, changing compensation schemes, modifying sales and marketing plans, hiring new senior compliance officers and independent monitors reporting to the prosecutor, firing key personnel, including chief executives and directors. So I think when you look at this broad picture, I would say that this problem does exist. And I think that's really sort of the rejoinder to Professor Klein's data here. I think it's important. I agree with her. We don't want to just look at anecdotes. We want to look at evidence. But when you have this broad swath of U.S. industry under any given point in time under Justice Department supervision, it's a real concern. Now, when it comes to things like the incarceration rates that Senator Lee was pointing to, I think that's where the data, the caseload data, do become relevant. I agree with Professor Steinzohr that some of these issues are disturbing, that some of the disparate impact is disturbing. The fact that Professor Klein pointed out a majority of U.S. caseload in this area, in the criminal law area, involves drug and immigration is something we need to think about. But that's really not what we're here to talk about today. We're talking about this regulatory corporate crime situation. And I think there are some serious concerns here. What are those? First, do these actually Does the enforcement here actually undermine compliance? And I've argued that in fact they do. I'm not alone in that. The conference board has expressed similar sorts of concerns. George Terwilliger talked about some of these earlier in the earlier panel. But take, for instance, the recent case of Ralph Lauren, which in 2013 entered under a non-prosecution agreement under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And they identified this. They implemented an aggressive new compliance program. They identified a situation where, and we're talking about the hundreds of thousands of dollars here, not a huge offense, where there were individuals in Argentina that were paying bribes to help with customs officials. They identified this, they remedied the situation, they went through a broad remediation program, and yet the Justice Department decided not to do a declination there, but in fact enter into a non-prosecution agreement. It's hard for me to see how that follows under the 2012 guidelines that Justice issued in this area, but the lack of transparency, which is one of my points, is part of the problem here. And as George was talking about in the prior panel, we have a stretching the law problem here, where really the Justice Department can act, and lay prosecutors can act as effective judge and jury here, can redefine the law, arguably, because the corporations are unable effectively to try these cases. And that's the underlying point here, is that corporations, unlike individuals, an individual facing jail time perhaps is also going to have to plead out a case, and that's certainly the norm, but a corporation cannot afford to take the risk of going to trial due to stock market effects, credit constraints, collateral consequences, which have been discussed, including debarment, exclusion from federal contracting, loss of licensing. HSBC was threatened with the loss of its U.S. banking license, had little discretion but to agree with the Justice Department here on this. And so even though there's Fifth Circuit precedent on point that Ralph Lauren might have tried to invoke, they weren't able to push this issue in court. Similarly, GlaxoSmithKline entering into a corporate integrity agreement in 2012 under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was not able to test a First Amendment claim that the Second Circuit recently embraced in the area there. They're talking about the line, which is sort of nebulous, between promotion and sharing of scientific evidence about pharmaceuticals that haven't gone through an FDA review. So over a $3 trillion fine imposed on the company. Interestingly, the general counsel there at the time was tried by the Justice Department, was not convicted, though the Justice Department got a withering rebuke from a federal judge in the case in terms of how it handled it. And in fact, in all of these sort of off-label drug situations, we've seen individuals not get prosecuted from these companies with billions of dollars of DPA costs. Territorialism, there's a global sweep to this, including non-US companies, and Royal Bank of Scotland, 82% owned by the UK government, fell under last year at an antitrust DPA, HSBC already remarked upon, and there's social costs to these, which I would argue are very difficult for legally trained but business and economics inexperienced prosecutors in the Justice Department to contemplate. So for instance, is the truthful dissemination of speech by a pharmaceutical company good or bad for the public health? In that case, you've at least got an agency determination and congressional determination that's relatively clear. But should the Justice Department have oversight over all interest rate submissions under the LIBOR case that underlay the Royal Bank of Scotland with sweeping global economic implications? After the HSBC DPA was brought, they sold 42 businesses, they exited 9 countries. So it may be the case that's a warranted response. Clearly companies like Angola and Myanmar could use capital from international banks, and the question is the degree to which the Justice Department is assessing these broad policy implications. Excuse me, that's my time. So I'll try to wrap up briefly with some of the reforms that we think could be useful here. First, the liability standards here, particularly at a global level, just looking at what's the respondeat superior rule. In other words, how much are you going to hold a corporation strictly liable for lower-level employees' actions? That's something that the Model Penal Code and foreign countries that do allow corporate criminal prosecutions take a different position on than the federal rule generally runs. Affirmative defenses, a compliance defense, we think could make a significant difference here to align compliance with the law rather than the enforcement regime. Sanctions, again, looking at debarment or exclusion. Do we really want to tell seniors on Medicare that they can't get the drug their doctor prescribes for them because the company's excluded from Medicare? Do we really want to tell our military that they can't get state-of-the-art weapons equipment based on this? I mean, I don't think the Justice Department really wants to actually do this. They always argue this away, but it is the sort of Damocles that I think is hanging over the negotiation process here. And then finally, transparency and oversight. And our friends across the pond in the United Kingdom have recently this winter developed their own standards for deferred prosecution agreements. I think we'd be well advised to pay attention there. The judge is very involved at all stages in the process. There have to be findings on the record. There has to be a weighing ex ante of evidence as well as the public interest in entering into these agreements. And these are the sorts of things that in any individual case, as Mr. Terwilliger said, companies may be averse to, but I think in the aggregate, to have some sort of systematic openness to this process would be a positive thing. Thank you.
Thanks for watching.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks, everyone, for having me here to speak today. It says in my bio, I spent the last 10 years as a prosecutor, so I'm used to doing rebuttal closing, getting the last word before the jury. I won't get the last word today, but I feel like this worked out nicely because Professor Steinsohr was criticizing DPAs sort of from the left and Mr. Copeland from the right. And so let me talk to you a little bit straight down the middle about why the department has increased the use of DPAs and NPAs in recent years. And why, in appropriate cases, they actually make some sense, although they're much maligned. So prior to the rise in the use of DPAs and NPAs, prosecutors basically faced a binary choice when confronted with corporate crime. You could either decline to prosecute or you could return an indictment. And NPAs and DPAs serve a crucial function in that they expand the range of options available to the Justice Department. Instead of the blunt instrument of decline or indict, that sort of binary choice, you have a spectrum of sanctions that you can choose from. And that's important because it allows DOJ to properly calibrate the sanctions in a particular case to the facts and circumstances in the case. That's necessary because the department has multiple objectives when dealing with corporate crime. And their objectives, and there are three main ones, which I'll talk about in a minute, and they can be in tension with one another. They're reflected in nine factors that are in the U.S. Attorney's Manual. You sometimes hear them referred to as the Philip factors or the Thompson memo factors. I don't know why Mr. Terwilliger didn't get factors named after him when he was the DAG, because that's usually where they come from, but we stopped naming them. I say it's old habits die hard. The department has stopped naming the factors after the DAGs, and now it's just the U.S. Attorney's Manual, the Principles of Prosecution of Business Organizations. So there are nine factors. I won't go through them, but I think they boil down to three primary, or they reflect three primary goals that the department has in when fashioning resolutions in response to corporate misconduct. So the first one is to appropriately punish the misconduct. The second is to incentivize and reward self-disclosure, cooperation, and compliance. And then the third is to minimize collateral consequences to innocent employees and third parties whenever possible. So let me talk about each in turn. And first is appropriately punish the misconduct. And that's the most important of the three for a few reasons. First, appropriately punishing corporate misconduct promotes confidence in the criminal justice system and the rule of law. Corporations and individuals both must play by the rules. When they break the rules, they must be held accountable. Bad behavior needs to be punished. Otherwise, and you've heard, I think, speakers from both sides of the spectrum today speak about this, if there's not adequate punishment when there's actual wrongdoing and actual law breaking, then confidence in the effectiveness of the judicial system can erode. Second, appropriately punishing misconduct is important from the Department of Justice's perspective because it serves a deterrence function. The fear of prosecution deters, and at least should deter, companies from engaging in illegal conduct in the first place. And it's better that the illegal conduct never happened than that the Department of Justice is prosecuting it on the back end. And that's particularly so when we're talking about regulatory crimes. Statutes like the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act or the Clean Water Act ensure that the drugs we give our kids when they're sick or the water that our kids go to swim in, that the drugs are safe and that the water is clean. And it's much better to have compliance with those laws on the front end than having to prosecute companies on the back end for having sold adulterated drugs or having polluted the water. And the best way to do that is to send the message that if you break the law, there will be real consequences. And then the third reason why it's important to appropriately punish misconduct is that it ensures an even playing field. If you want to look at it from a sort of pure business perspective, the companies who do play by the rules shouldn't be punished or shouldn't be at a competitive disadvantage for doing so. If the lawbreakers aren't punished, then those who are playing by the rules may feel disadvantaged and may wonder why they're doing so. But that's not the only goal. It's an important goal, but it's not the only goal to punish bad behavior. Another goal is to incentivize and reward self-disclosure, cooperation, and compliance, and that's important too. DOJ has limited resources. You wouldn't think it from some of the comments here today, but there are limited resources and have to allocate those resources wisely, and it really can be a force multiplier when corporations cooperate. It allows the department to entertain many more investigations simultaneously if companies are cooperating with those investigations rather than hiring expensive law firms to fight tooth and nail every step of the way. Similarly and relatedly, if every corporation were made to plead guilty, there's no incentive to cooperate. In other words, if you want to get the benefit of that force multiplication, you have to offer companies some tangible benefit when they agree to cooperate and help advance the investigation. And one way to do that is by using DPAs or NPAs instead of guilty pleas in appropriate cases. And then there's a third goal, which is to minimize collateral consequences to innocent employees and third parties when that's possible. You've heard it here today earlier, an indictment can mean a corporate death sentence. And sometimes that's appropriate. Sometimes the conduct is egregious enough that's the appropriate sanction. But other times it's not. And you got to understand that when you impose a corporate death sentence, that doesn't just mean that the CEO loses his or her job. It also means that the secretaries lose theirs, and the mail clerks lose theirs, and people who had nothing to do with the criminal conduct lose their pensions. And that's not a reason standing by itself not to indict. But it's a factor and a real factor that needs to be considered in the mix of factors when prosecutors are making these very important decisions on how to treat corporate misconduct. I think it's easy for critics to say that every corporate case should be indicted or result in a guilty plea. That's great. It makes a great soundbite, and it's great if all your only goal were the first of the three I just mentioned. If all you were concerned about is appropriately punishing or punishing severely the corporate misconduct, then fine, indict away. Insist on a guilty plea in every case. But it doesn't. If you insist on the guilty plea in every case, as I mentioned earlier, I think you're shortchanging the other two goals, which are also important, which is to incentivize cooperation and to avoid collateral consequences where possible. And then, critics on the other side may say there should be a complete compliance defense. In fact, Mr. Copeland said it. There should be a complete compliance defense. So that basically, as long as you can prove you had a pre-existing compliance program, you shouldn't then be indicted if afterwards, despite the compliance program, you broke the law. That approach really serves the second goal I mentioned well. That definitely would incentivize compliance, but it doesn't fare as well when you talk about appropriately punishing the misconduct and the law breaking if that law breaking does occur, notwithstanding the compliance program. So I guess it's a long way of saying that a deferred prosecution agreement in the appropriate case, given the facts and circumstances of each case, actually can balance those three goals effectively and can be the right result. But notwithstanding that, there is a perception issue, and a DPA just isn't perceived the same way as a guilty plea is. When it's announced that a company has received a deferred prosecution agreement, even though it's similar to a guilty plea in a lot of ways, a lot of money gets paid to the government. The company has to admit wrongdoing in a fulsome statement of facts. There's a term of the deferred prosecution agreement can be seen as equivalent to the term of probation, which is all you could get if you convicted the company at trial or if they pled guilty. Nonetheless, the perception is that the company got off or bought its way out of trouble. And that's important, that perception, because that ties back to people having confidence in the system and ties back to there being deterrence. It's important not just that the department reach what is a fair result in each case, but that it reach a resolution that is perceived to be fair. So let me just briefly talk about two things that I think the department is doing but should continue to do to help change that perception when it comes to DPAs. First, where the evidence supports it, the department should pair the DPA with the indictment of culpable individuals. I think there's universal agreement that the best way to change illegal behavior is to prosecute individual corporate executives for misconduct when that misconduct occurs. Paying a fine with shareholders' money is one thing, but nothing concentrates the mind like the prospect of going to federal prison. Second, where appropriate, when the facts and circumstances justify it, the department should require that the parent company plead guilty. It's tough for people to understand this sort of spectrum of sanctions, this ability to calibrate the punishment to the crime, if one end of the spectrum is only rarely used. And you can't require the parent company to plead guilty just to prove that the department is tough. I think, maybe I misheard him, but Mr. Terwilliger, I thought I heard him suggest earlier that the department is changing its prosecution policies, or that its prosecution policies are being influenced by politics or political pressure, and that's, at least on my experience, nothing could be further from the truth. You can't bring indictments or require companies to plead guilty just because it's politically popular. That's not how the Department of Justice works, and it isn't how it should work. They need to stand apart and call things on the merits. But in an appropriate case, I think the department should have a parent company plead guilty. There was an article in the New York Times just a week or so ago that got a lot of attention. It was about Credit Suisse and BNP Paribas, and the article suggested that shortly that the department will be requiring parent-level corporate guilty pleas from those two companies, and I don't know whether that's true or not. But I do want to take issue with one thing in the article, which said that the fact that these corporate guilty pleas were going to be required represented a shift in strategy for the Department of Justice. And I don't think that's right. I don't think it's a shift in strategy at all. I think it's a reflection of the department's consistent approach of calling these things on the merits, of looking at each case, assessing all the facts and circumstances, evaluating them against the factors in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, and then figuring out what the appropriate resolution is. So regardless of what happens, I think it may be time. It may be that these companies, for whatever the mix of factors are, whether it's a lack of cooperation, whether it's the egregiousness of the conduct, whether it's the ability to mitigate the collateral consequences, it may be that a corporate parent guilty plea is appropriate. But I don't think if that ends up happening, that represents a shift in strategy by the department, or that the department was soft on companies before and is now getting tough. And I think that if you look at the department's entire record, I think that's borne out. You'll see that individuals are being charged in appropriate cases. In LIBOR, there were two individuals charged in UBS, three in Rabobank, and three in ICAP. And parent corporations are taking guilty pleas. Marubeni is a Japanese corporation where the parent recently pled guilty in an FCPA violation. My time is up. I just want to, touch base briefly on the regulatory regulatory crimes, because Senator Lee spoke about it, and others have spoken about it too, about the, and have used examples where the regulatory statutes maybe were used in a way to prosecute someone who, I think folks, you know, when they hear the story, or at least hear one side of the story, says, I don't understand why we have those statutes and why they were used that way. I would just point out that there are examples. There are other examples of how those statutes are used, that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is the statute that was used to prosecute the Peanut Corporation of America, which was linked to a salmonella outbreak that killed a number of people. The Clean Water Act is the statute that was used to prosecute BP for spilling millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf. So it's not just these sort of one-off examples that that folks are able to find, but it's, these statutes also played a vital role in keeping our drug supply and food supply safe and in keeping our environment clean. Thanks.
Hi. I'm delighted to be here. This has been a fascinating conversation. I just want to start by disclosing that I'm not a criminal law expert at all. And so what I want to do is step back and put this discussion in the context of administrative enforcement more broadly. And in particular, I want to focus on what I will call sort of ordinary regulatory compliance and the role of the President and Congress in overseeing that work. So my premise is that we have lots of people in the government doing great work throughout the agencies, but we still nonetheless have a regulatory compliance problem. You're all well aware of massive crises that have resulted from regulatory violations. Rena focused on these, like the financial meltdown, the BP oil spill, the Massey mine explosion, just from the last couple of years. But there's also a problem of far more routine and less high-profile non-compliance. So take labor and employment regulation as an example. In a recent study of low-wage workers, workers below the poverty line, in three major cities, 26% of workers surveyed were paid less than the legally required minimum wage in the previous work week before the survey. And 76% of those who worked more than 40 hours were not paid the legally required overtime rate. This essentially amounts to wage theft, and it advantages companies who violate the law over law-abiding companies. We have similar problems in other regulatory areas. These are not problems that sort of rise to the level of the BP oil spill or other major crises, but ranging from food safety to the environment, sort of ordinary non-compliance with the law. The argument I want to make today is that as a matter of both good public policy and of constitutional governance, leaders of both political branches can and should focus more on reducing regulatory noncompliance. And that there's some relatively basic administrative reforms, many of which are already underway, that could improve the situation, and that even putting aside the problem of criminal enforcement. So by way of background, I'll say a few words about how the political branches have historically overseen administrative enforcement. And I think it's useful to compare the oversight of regulatory compliance work and enforcement to the oversight of rulemaking. There's been a great deal of presidential and congressional attention to rulemaking. So everyone is probably well familiar with OIRA. An office like OIRA has existed since the Nixon administration. The office analyzes the costs and benefits of rules. Congress also has paid great attention to rulemaking. It has the Congressional Review Act, which enables it to review rules before they go into effect, and numerous additional proposals have been floated which would increase congressional control over rulemaking. In essence, both branches have really claimed ownership over regulatory policy. By comparison, leaders in both the executive branch and Congress have paid much less formal attention to problems of regulatory compliance, to problems of enforcement. So to be sure, we see lots of focus on enforcement after major failures, but there are fewer systems in place to deal with sort of ordinary regulatory noncompliance. So I think I'll talk a little bit about, I think there's been a great deal of progress recently in this administration to put in place, to encourage agencies to coordinate regulatory compliance work, to measure the efficacy of agencies in achieving compliance, and to help them do so more effectively, but still much more can be done. And within Congress, there's also been much less oversight of this kind of regulatory compliance work. There's clearly some attention from GAO. Some committees have sporadically focused on enforcement problems, but compared to the degree of attention that gets paid to regulation, it's not been nearly as much. I think there's also been a troubling willingness to cut regulatory enforcement budgets, even when the underlying substantive statutory commands remain unchanged. So to some extent, one could put a positive spin on this comparative lack of attention to regulatory compliance. So first, if you take the executive branch, there are good reasons, I think, for any president to be cautious about involvement in enforcement. Certainly, any kind of involvement in individual criminal enforcement actions raised by the president himself raises concerns. There's also good reasons to avoid too much centralization of enforcement efforts or regulatory compliance efforts. I think Dan Richman mentioned this earlier. So, you know, if the president tried to coordinate enforcement the same way OIRA coordinates regulation, I think we'd be likely to see enforcement efforts slow down considerably. So from this vantage point, staying away from administrative enforcement could be seen as a virtue. And likewise, with respect to Congress, you could tell a positive story about sort of staying away from the problem of regulatory compliance. It's, after all, the president's job to take care that the law is enforced. And lack of regulatory attention to regulatory compliance could therefore be seen as appropriate deference to a coordinate branch. But I think there's also less salutary explanations for the neglect of regulatory compliance. One explanation I would give is that it's really hard to do this work well, and there are few political upsides to uncovering problems and taking ownership over them. And this problem of sort of the difficulty of actually engaging in regulatory compliance work is exacerbated by the fact that, notwithstanding expanding mandates, there's decreased funding for enforcement work. Another reason is that since the 1980s, much of the political attention in the administrative sphere has been to deregulation. So non-enforcement and underfunding of enforcement efforts have actually been used as a tool to achieve deregulation, but this has often happened non-transparently. So I think that this is a problem from both a policy perspective and a constitutional governance perspective, and that you know, achieving compliance with the law is something we should all care quite a bit about. Rick started off by saying, it makes the promise of the law real, and failure to effectively enforce regulations gives non-complying entities an unfair competitive advantage, undermines social welfare, and decreases trust in government. Neglect of regulatory compliance, I think, can also be an abdication of executive and congressional responsibility under the Constitution. So the president has an obligation to take care that law is executed. And Congress has some obligation here as well to provide funds to ensure that the executive responsibility can be met. So is where to go with all that? I think that worries about politics and over-centralization are important and should be considered when in the context of any reforms, but that those worries should not be an excuse for failing to pay attention to the problem. So I want to suggest just a couple of ways that we can improve this situation, even assuming no significant new appropriations for enforcement work, and even assuming, even putting aside the use of the criminal law. So first, much has been done, much progress has been made in the last few years to coordinate regulatory compliance work across agencies. But more still could be done. So, you know, most regulated entities need to comply with a host of regulation, not just those enforced by one agency. So if you think of, say, an egg farm, right, where we've seen some major salmonella outbreaks, those farms have to comply with OSHA, with wage and hour rules, with USDA, with FDA, DHS, EPA, all of those agencies are enforcing their regulations. But too frequently, there's been a lack of coordination among these agencies, and therefore little ability to target resources to the worst offenders or to use the tools of one agency to help advance the missions of another. Recently, we've seen a shift to greater interagency coordination. So agencies have signed a number of memorandum MOUs to coordinate enforcement against joint targets, or in which they agree that one agency will step back in order not to interfere with another agency's enforcement efforts. I think those are positive developments, but there's more that can be done to institutionalize those throughout the government. Second, much more could be done to improve data quality and data infrastructure and to make the compliance records of regulated entities more accessible across the government and to the public. This would enable much more strategic enforcement even with the existing resources. So it's really quite striking how poor the quality of data is in many agencies. It's hard to tell what businesses are related to one another. Often just the names and addresses of businesses are wrong, but certainly corporate structures are often opaque. Data often isn't usable across agencies, and this makes strategic enforcement and coordination very difficult. President Obama issued a memo directing agencies to share data and for OMB to play a role in that, but there's still, again, much more work that could be done. Third, I think more could be done to encourage agencies to involve stakeholders, including nonprofit organizations, in joint efforts to achieve regulatory compliance. And again, just to go back to the area of wage theft, the example I started with, a number of states and localities have had great success with this kind of tripartite method, where nonprofit organizations are used either to help with educating about what regulations are, with inspections, with sort of various points during the regulatory compliance process. Fourth, another possible creative and not terribly expensive tactic is that during the federal procurement process, more demerits could be imposed on companies that have significant records of non-compliance in their supply chain. So President Clinton actually issued an EO that would have accomplished that, but was subsequently rescinded. So I'm not saying that it's not worth debating more systemic reforms. There's all sorts of other sort of broader questions that come up in the context of administrative enforcement. Should we have more ex-ante enforcement versus ex-post enforcement, more involvement, more public enforcement versus private enforcement, steeper penalties, criminal enforcement? Those are all really important, hard questions. But even within the existing framework, there are sort of relatively minor and technical changes that could I think significantly improve outcomes. And if nothing else, it's worth thinking about the problem of criminal enforcement within the context of regulatory compliance more broadly. Thanks.
So I want to give the panelists a couple of minutes to respond to each other before I open it up to you all for questions. So with that.
To that score, I want to emphasize that I think Mr. Axelrod did do a good job of laying out the rationale for a sort of interstitial role for deferred prosecution agreements. I understand that logic in terms of not wanting a binary type of outcome, and I wouldn't want to take the position that there should never be anything like a deferred prosecution agreement. I do think that it's a little strange to think that these are as necessary as they have become, when from 1788 to 1993 we had zero, and from 1993 to 2003 we had 17, and in the last 10 years we've had 278. So I do think that there's quite a paradigm shift that's gone on here, and I think that's important. But I think the arguments he laid out for these, deterrence, leveling the playing field, self-disclosure, compliance, minimizing collateral consequences are all good. The one that I think is a little strange conceptually is the concept of punishment. And that doesn't mean that criminal law is not all about punishment. And individuals who commit fraud should be punished. But when we talk about corporations, we're talking about combinations of employees, customers, creditors, stockholders. And so the notion that there's inadequate punishment of wrongdoing with a compliance defense strikes me a little hollow. And I want to emphasize a complete compliance defense. I don't think I said a complete compliance defense. I think I said an affirmative defense. Obviously, there'd be fact questions. Obviously, you just can't say, here's our compliance department, stick a thing up on the wall and do nothing, and then have it. That shouldn't be an effective compliance defense. I think it's not impossible, but I think it's very difficult for a lot of these companies to litigate these questions. But I don't think the reason to reject an affirmative compliance defense should be that the corporation per se isn't punished. I also really, Matt's first point and things that he suggested doing, pairing DPAs or corporate level prosecutions with the indictment of culpable individuals, I think makes sense. I mean, I would prefer that they become sort of necessarily linked, because it's very disturbing to me that you have multi-billion dollar penalties imposed and substantial changes in business conduct imposed by people who were English majors with law degrees on major corporations without any individual at that corporation being indicted for the underlying predicate conduct.
Now you're attacking my industry.
So first of all, I resemble that remark as an English major. Although, as Jim knows, I married an MBA who happened to be a classmate of Jim's at business school. Just a couple of responses. Thank you for your comments. So on compliance, I think there's a concern from the department that if you had even an affirmative compliance defense, that what would result is you would have just trials over whether the compliance defense was adequate, like whether the compliance was adequate, what type of compliance pro. And so I think, you know, from the department's perspective, better to have, if you're going to have a trial, better to have a trial about the actual conduct and whether the conduct was criminal or not, about then whether the compliance program was a paper program or a real program. But, you know, reasonable people can disagree. On individuals, you know, I think as you were talking, it struck me that one of the additional benefits from prosecuting individuals when possible and when appropriate is that I think it gets at one of the problems that others have touched on today, which is that some of these issues they don't end up getting litigated because the company can't take the indictment. They can't take the uncertainty that comes with a standing indictment. They need to sort of package it in a resolution. And so I think that there's a feeling, I've heard it from defense attorneys, and I've heard it here today, that sometimes at the department, hopefully people believe in good faith, believes in its legal theory, but the defense in its good faith feels that legal theory is invalid, but they have no choice but to accept a resolution. If more individuals were prosecuted under similar theories, then the individuals, you know, they have incentive to plead guilty too, but some of them would go to trial, and then those issues would get more fleshed out. So I think that's another collateral benefit of prosecuting individuals when it's appropriate.
So let me turn it over to you all. First question, yeah.
Regulation from WHO and in the area of international trade, you know, and
back at it. So I don't know if it's the company you're talking about, but the department did have a big resolution recently with an Indian pharmaceutical manufacturer called Ranbaxy for substandard production. And look, I think you're right. I think the world is becoming every day more interlinked. And it was interesting. I don't know if you were here for Senator Lee's comments, which I thought were interesting because he's advocating sort of less federal enforcement and more, you know, back to the states. At the same time that, you know, from my perspective, the world is getting more not just national but international. I don't think you can have the department sort of relying on, you know, there's enough criticism when the department is enforcing a crime that's sort of a crime because of U.S. regulations. I can only imagine what the criticism would be if it were a crime because it violated some international or foreign regulation. But I think the department will continue to prosecute corporate law breaking, regardless of whether that corporation is a U.S. corporation or a foreign corporation, assuming the U.S. statutes provide jurisdiction over the foreign corporation. So if you look at the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act prosecution record of the department, for example, it's a real mix. It's a mix of foreign companies and U.S. companies. And I think one of the criticisms the department has heard over the years is that we have stricter rules here in the U.S. and our companies are at a competitive disadvantage internationally. And I think if you look at the prosecution record, that's really not borne out, that the prosecutors are looking at the conduct of international companies, at least ones that have a U.S. nexus and can be reached by U.S. criminal laws, just as they're looking at holding U.S. companies accountable for the misconduct.
Can I just say something very quick? 80% of the components of drugs are imported in this country, which is kind of stunning when you think about it. I don't think most Americans realize that. I think that the degeneration of the regulatory system, which harmonization could mean if we are having a race to the bottom, is actually very bad news for business, because what is happening is we're getting into an area where we're shifting to self-regulation, and the SCOTF laws don't regulate themselves, and so they give everybody a bad name, and then the only alternative is to prosecute them criminally, which of course I, in desperation at the state of the regulatory system from the left, say is the only thing we can do now because these agencies are under such attack. So I actually think it's bad news for business that we don't have a stronger system that sets standards in an aggressive way. I mean, the FDA is a mess.
Well, if you look at FDA and EPA, they focus on science-based regulation,
right,
and risk management, risk assessment. I mean, we were talking about impacts on shareholders, employees, and things like this. But there are also bigger risks to society and nations that also have to be addressed. So I think the reason why the FDA, this globalization group, says that it is no longer able to regulate
right.
the safety for Americans. In other words, in this go round, I think that this issue is getting bigger in terms of what's at stake and what are the responsibilities of government, industry, and society in this international stakeholder sort of model that we're going forward. But I think that the race to the bottom is a reality, but I think the bigger reality is to build the capacity, not just in developing countries, but transatlantically, trans-Pacific, which is what this new generation of trade agreements is doing, and huge regulatory areas in them. So
I think it's a very important question. It's something that we focused on a lot. I think, just to clarify something Mr. Axelrod said, I mean, there certainly are instances in which there are prosecutions in the United States of violations of foreign laws. I mean, the Gibson guitar wood importation case that Senator Lee alluded to in his comments is precisely that. And it was basically a protectionist statute in India that was the underlying predicate offense there. I think the Justice Department, as I suggested, some of these DPAs have significant international implications. So I didn't just bring up Myanmar and Angola. I mean, they asked they said, wait a minute, you're getting HSBC to pull out of our country based on this? This is we don't want them to pull out of our country. And so I think there's a lot of concern here. And under the FCPA, I mean, Matt's right, they do prosecution of foreign companies. Sometimes they're foreign companies for alleged foreign bribes in foreign countries. And the only nexus to the United States is that there's a dollar-denominated transaction that has to clear through a U.S. bank, or that there's an email that ends up getting routed through a U.S. email router. And on the basis of that, we're policing what foreign companies are doing in foreign countries. Again, very significant international considerations to this. I mean, it may be that's what we want to do, but it's not a clear congressional directive that that's what we ought to be doing. And when I challenged senior Justice Department people on this at a forum last year, they said, well, we only do that because the foreign country doesn't enforce the same rule we do. If they wanted to enforce that rule, we'd stop doing it. I'm not sure that's the right way to think about these sorts of cases.
Are there other questions?
So you're saying that if a kid took an antibiotic that had no active ingredients and got a very severe infection, an American kid, you're not suggesting that...
There's a clear U.S. nexus to that, but that's not what I was talking about. I mean, I'm not saying that foreign countries cannot fall, foreign companies cannot fall under U.S. jurisdiction, but a lot of these are talking about substantially foreign activities by foreign companies.
But that's not what she was talking about. She was talking about drugs that are made that have problems made for Americans from, I believe, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, product safety, consumer protection, supply chain, counterfeit drugs.
I'll let Kate weigh in, then I want to move on to another question.
I think your question hits on a really pressing challenge, and the response I was going to give is something you just mentioned, which is this now really central subject of negotiations and treaties, which I think is really important. I do think we want to be wary, though, of centralizing decision-making too much into treaties so that we don't have multiple levers of participation and, like we have in our federal system, we also have the EU's own regulations have been helpful in increasing product safety sort of all along the supply chain because they have more stringent product safety regulations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. So I take your question to implicate the issue of the breadth, at least to my mind, the breadth of discretion, and it's, we haven't really touched that much on, it's almost completely unpoliced discretion, right, that prosecutors have to either bring these actions, not bring these actions, selectively bring these actions, and it ties into something I wanted to ask. We're running out of time, but maybe just briefly, there have been touches both in this panel and this morning, brief mentions of separation of powers issues, the lack of any judicial oversight or some the lack of any real transparency. Jim mentioned some of this in terms of allowing the public to see what criteria are going into these decisions, and allowing maybe a more impartial third party, maybe the judiciary, to try to police some of these imbalances. And I'd like to just get thoughts on whether that would be good or bad, because I think you can make a lot of arguments that, we don't want judges, as much as we don't want prosecutors setting the terms of a DPA or something like that, they can at least, as, again, to just give Professor Richmond more airtime, they can at least talk to, say, Ben Lawski, and talk to other regulators and decide what's going into a DPA, where judges can't really do that as much. Same thing when it comes to transparency. Maybe the public isn't the best institution or the best constituency to be driving the substance of some of these agreements. So I'd be curious just to hear from some of our panelists on those issues.
Well, I suggested the idea and said the UK could be a model we could look at. But I think we ought to look at how it actually works in practice, but I'll let the others comment.
Yeah, I mean, if the question is, should judges play a more robust role in evaluating
DPAs,
approving DPAs or NPAs, it's an interesting question, and reasonable people can disagree. I guess where I come down is that the current system works pretty well, that I actually think they are at least fairly transparent, because the terms of the deferred prosecution agreement are at least deferred prosecution agreements. This isn't always true with non-prosecution agreements, but deferred prosecution agreements are public. There's a robust factual statement about the conduct that occurred, and I think if you read them, you can generally have a sense of like what the conduct was and why the resolution is the way it is. If there's cooperation, it's usually acknowledged somewhere. And the other thing I think, and maybe this ties with what Jim was just saying, and I know this from firsthand experience, having recently worked in the DAG's office, looking at a lot of these things, they're really fact intensive, and so I don't know. I think the defense attorneys for the company and the prosecutors who are in the weeds know the facts the best. I think understand why the thing is crafted the way it is. And I'm not sure. Just like you don't have judges. Judges have a role to play, and when someone pleads guilty, but it's not a sort of a tear the thing apart and decide what the judge thinks the guilty plea should have been. And I don't know.
In fact, they don't. They tend not to do much at all in the guilty plea context. I wish we could. There are always exceptions. I'd love to. I wish we could keep going. We actually have to wrap up. I believe Senator Whitehouse has just joined us. So please join me in thanking our panelists.